So today, we're acknowledging and celebrating Earth Day, which is coming up this Wednesday. So I wanted to read the scripture that talks about the creation of the earth. And I'll admit I'm feeling a little bit split this morning, because on the one hand, I want to talk about the glory of creation. I want to talk about all of the beauty that is nature. I want to talk about how inspiring the glory of the world's most beautiful, pristine areas inspire us. And at the same time, I'm very, very troubled by the state of our environment and what we are doing to it. So forgive me if I tend to swing back and forth between absolute awe and intense anger. You may not know this about me, but I am a haphazard environmentalist. And I say haphazard because I blunder my way through trying to make the world a better place by leaving gardens everywhere I go, though they tend to be messy. Some years ago, just as I was graduating from seminary and had not yet found a full-time job, I accidentally backed into the worm farming business, for example. It's true. I backed into the worm farming business. It started so simply. See, my mother's birthday was coming up. It was exactly this time of year. And she has this wonderful garden. And we were living at her house, me and my girls, and we're cooking all of these meals out of the garden. And we had all these kitchen scraps. And so I casually mentioned, you know, there's these little things you can get. They're called worm farms. Have you heard of these? They're like a little thing with some worms in there. And you put your kitchen scraps and they make them into this wonderful compost. The children are making a break for it. Fear not. They have adult supervision. So, no, they are not. So, I, you know, talked to her about this, and for her birthday, I purchased a small worm farm. It was like a series of little trays. It was about this big, and it just sat out on the back porch, and we would put our scraps in there. And I bought a pound of worms because I was told that worms will compost about half their weight per day. And I thought, half a pound of scraps, a pound of worms, perfect. Worm farm. What we were not prepared for was how quickly those little suckers grew fruitful and multiplied. We could hear them at night. They had a little Barry White going, right? We found the champagne bottles the next morning. We knew exactly what they were up to. And before we knew it, they had outgrown their container, and we had probably more like 4 or 5 pounds of worms. So I'm feeding them as fast as we can. We're saving all of the kitchen scraps, and they continue to grow. So a couple things happened. First of all, I started building more bins. I could not purchase more bins. Those things are pricey if you purchase them. So I started building them out of Rubbermaid tubs that I would get at like the Goodwill for a couple of dollars. And they outgrew those as well. So I started investigating what's called flow-through composters, and I reverse engineered one that I saw online, and I sew felt into a gigantic funnel. It stands about 4 feet tall, goes down like this on a PVC frame. So I'm building these things. Well, they outgrew that, and they outgrew another one and another one. And next thing you know, I had 7 of these suckers going, plus multiple Rubbermaid tubs. I'm collecting about 40 to 50 gallons of waste from various cafes and restaurants around Albany. In my little car, I had a little Honda Accord, and I'm trying to put all this stuff in the trunk. And at a certain point, I did the math. I had about 300 gallons of compost and worms going at a time, and feeding them 50 gallons of food a day. The environment knows how to sustain itself. The environment knows how to live in a symbiotic system. Those worms knew how to adapt to their environment, eat waste, and produce something wonderful with it. The world knows what it's doing if we don't mess it up. So, how many of you have actually read this section before? I mean, I know you've heard about it. I know you've heard it told to you. How many of you have actually read it before today? Good, good. So, at my previous church, at one point I was teaching Bible study, and we were talking actually about the passages, the most controversial passages in the Bible that have been used to disenfranchise the LGBT community. And we were going through those and debunking them. And I had an anonymous question box. And I asked if anybody has any questions, they can throw them in the question box. And the question got some really good ones, let me tell you. But the one that surprised me the most asked simply, did dinosaurs really exist?
Yes.
Thank you. I wish you had been there. It would have been a very short, pointed Bible study class. Did dinosaurs really exist? And there was another one from a different person. Was evolution real? It asked. Now, this was in the heart of Silicon Valley. We had, within driving distance, UC Berkeley, right? Stanford, the people, the minds that created things like Google, Facebook, eBay, and there were still people that weren't 100% sure whether or not dinosaurs really existed. And I started getting more questions like, how will we ever be able to reconcile creationism and evolution, really? And it might be easy for us to be dismissive. It might be easy for us to laugh at this question. But really, it shocked me because it showed how much damage churches can do when they misinform people. And this, we discussed last week, doubting Thomas and how we should give Thomas a really big break because he asked good questions. He wanted proof. He wanted to get to the heart of the facts. He didn't want to just take anybody's word for it, and we need to respect that. Well, I realized when I got this question that sometimes churches just need to be a safe place for people to bring this. These were adults. These were educated adults that were bringing these questions. And I can't imagine how long they had been holding this in today's society, trying to find a safe place to ask it. And the only place they could find to ask it was in a church anonymous question box at a Bible study class. I had to take it seriously. So we had a discussion, a huge Bible study class, all about creationism versus evolution. And I explained to them what I'm going to explain to you because I guarantee you that there are people in this room that are wondering. There's just a little doubt. And I guarantee you that there are people that will listen to this on the podcast that have the same question. And it's an important question. It might be easy to say, oh, people who believe in creation versus evolution, we can just dismiss them. They don't know what they're talking about. It's so easy to dismiss the other side. But it's important because it has huge implications for our environment. Huge implications, and let me explain to you why. If people believe that there is a huge dispute between what the Bible says and what scientists say, and they believe that the Bible is correct and scientists are wrong on how this world was created and came into being, then when we're talking about how this world might end with global warming, it's very easy for them to say, well, if the scientists didn't know what they were talking about for the creation of the world, then why should we believe them when they're telling us that it's going to end? Do you see the problem? What we believe makes a difference. And this is not a small fringe group. These people are lawmakers. These folks teach in schools. These folks, if they don't believe that global warming is real, if they believe in things like the rapture coming within the next 50 to 100 years, and many of them do, then what's the point of recycling? What's the point of conserving water? What's the point of, you know, asking businesses to curb the amount of toxic substances they throw into our waters and our air? If we can't trust scientists because they are in dispute with the Bible, then why should we believe them and take care of our environment? Does that make sense? This is how the logic works. This is why this is so important. So let's just take a minute to talk about this. And many of you may already have heard this. You may already know it, but I'm going to go over it anyway. So, creationism is a belief system. Regardless of what facts are presented, people will still believe it. That's how a belief system works. In fact, the more facts that are presented to the contrary, usually the stronger the belief becomes. So, in the beginning of the Bible, in chapter 1, we hear about how the earth was created in 7 days. The theory of evolution is a theory that was developed by Charles Darwin back in the 1800s. Around 1859, he published a book called The Origin of the Species. Now, in that book, he talked about how over time, species will adapt to their environment, and they will change, and that is how species evolve and how they've come to be in their present day. And in that book, he also postured that that humans and apes shared a common ancestor way, way back, way, 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 way back, like on the cellular level. At a certain point, they split. One line went on to become the apes that we know, and another line went on to become human beings. Now, the problem with this is that someone grossly misinterpreted it. And a few years later, a guy named, wait, I wrote it down, Thomas Huxley, looked at humans and looked at apes and saw a lot of similarities, right? And assumed that maybe along the lines of evolution, things like chimpanzees turned into humans. And he published a book on this. Now, that book has since been debunked. Scientists said there's no way that happened. We don't have any proof of that. And they've been able to disprove it. But in the meantime, some people got a bee in their bonnet about this and started saying there's no way we descended from apes. And we've been arguing about it ever since, even though it's a non-issue. Do you see the problem? Do you see how that happened? Okay. So then we get into things like the famous monkey trial and that sort of thing because someone taught evolution in schools back in, was the 30s, 40s, 50s? 20s? Was it really the 20s? Thank you. Were you there? Do you remember? Okay, thank you. Thank you. That's awesome. That's awesome. Okay, so what we have now is this argument about who's right, scientists or the Bible. And the problem is scientific theory has been tested and tested and tested. By the point it reaches the idea of the level of theory, it means that it's been tested so many times and been subjected to so many peer reviews that people don't argue about it anymore. Like, for example, the theory of gravity is still considered a theory, but it's been tested so many times. How many of you guys have dropped something in your kitchen and it hits the floor? Has anyone here ever dropped anything and it floated up? It's still a theory, but it's understood to be pretty much factual at this point. So, when we look at the account in Genesis, it has some issues with it. For example, the light appears on the first day or second day before the sun and the moon appear. Do you see that? Now, how would the light appear before the sun was in the sky? And how could all of this happen over just a single day, each thing? Some people say, well, there's this passage in Psalms that says, for the Lord a day is as a thousand years and a thousand years is as a day. So maybe that's how, maybe when he says a day, he really means like some thousands of years. Well, then I would like to know how all of the plants grew on that planet for a thousand years or so before the sun ever appeared in the sky. Do you see the problem? So, what this is historiographical literature. It is written to make a point about God. It is written not to be 100% historically accurate, because of course whoever was writing this was not there to observe it. Right? It is written with the understanding that it's trying to teach you something about God. So let's look at what it's teaching us about God and how people understood God. First of all, we see again and again that creation is good. This world is good. The creepy, crawly things on the ground are good. The plants and the trees and the animals are good. Human beings, men and women, created at the same time together are good. They are inherently good. They're not just good, they're very good. Do you see that? They're very good. Creation is a blessing, and it's good. We also see that this is a very orderly universe. Each plant creates seeds that will produce more of the same plant. You can't plant a peach seed and end up with asparagus. It doesn't happen. Am I right? You can't put an apple tree in the ground and expect cucumbers to come up. It's orderly. You can save your seeds and plant more of the same and be able to perpetuate things that are good and that sustain. It's very orderly. And so we also find out, because it was so orderly and everything was so methodically laid out, that God was definitely a Methodist. You heard it here first. And we also learn, because this was an agricultural society, and I have studied this society in depth, This was an agricultural society. 90% of the people that lived at the time that this was written worked in agriculture. They owned farms, they worked farms, they owned vineyards and orchards, they sold the food from their farms, they used it to feed themselves. Only 10% did not work actively in agriculture. And so they understood that creation is good, that it is a blessing, and that we are stewards of it. We must sustain the earth in order for it to sustain us. They understood that relationship with the land. They understood that we must care for the garden. We must take care of the earth if it is going to continue to sustain us the way we need to be able to be sustained. Now, in this society, we've been removed from that. We don't always see where our food comes from. We're not always tilling the soil in order to get the food that sustains us. We go to the grocery store, we buy it off the shelves. Nowadays, we're starting to get back into farmers market so we can actually talk directly with the people that till the soil. But in general, we've got a disconnect. The people who wrote this, the people who heard this and read this, did not have that disconnect. And when we look at the way they understood that the earth was created, they weren't actually far off. There are some discrepancies between when the lights appeared and when the sun appeared. But in general, what they saw was that there was sort of a watery, slurry chaos. And out of that, dry land appeared. And then the order is pretty much right on. The creepy crawlies in the water, then the creepy crawlies on the earth, then the birds in the air, and then the more domesticated animals and mammals that we have nowadays, and people. Do you see that? Their order is not that far off. Considering the fact that they did not have the technology or the knowledge that we have now, they got it pretty right on. There is not as much of a dispute between what evolution says happened and what the Bible says happened as people would like you to believe. People who want to foster that argument are gaining something from it. And the things that they're gaining are the ability to continue pumping toxins into the water and not have to pay fees for it. There's money and power behind this argument, I guarantee you. Whenever you see people continuing to argue something that's really not an argument, someone's benefiting financially. So rather than arguing with one another, it's best to look to see what's happening to our earth and what we can do to stop it. Does that make sense? So, I remember reading an article ages ago about what to teach the next generation and how nowadays it's so common. And I've seen this in my own children's school where they just pummel them with statistics. This is how much water we have left. This is how many trees are dying. This is how much, you know, what will happen if the entire planet is destroyed because of global warming. And those are important facts and we need to take them seriously. But when we dump those on children, it's impossible. It's impossible for them to be able to absorb those and do something about it in a meaningful manner. Do you understand that? It's just too much for them. It's just too much for them. And they tend to shut down. I remember being in an ethics class when I was in seminary, and the teacher, this was not one of my finer moments, the teacher was lecturing, talking about how kids these days just don't care, how apathy is a major problem, because he keeps going into classrooms. He said every time we test this stuff, we go into the classrooms, and he started talking about how when he would pummel them with this information, the kids would just shut off. They would just tune out. You'd see their eyes glaze over, and they couldn't get them to care that much about what was happening with the environment. And he kept saying over and over again that kids are apathetic, and it's a major problem with this generation. And he went on and on and on about it. Now, I had taught high school. And let me tell you, these kids were passionate, and they were engaged, and they were actively seeking information and wanting to do something good with this world, so I could not understand this disconnect. And I didn't realize, he was just quoting all of these figures and kept calling kids apathetic, and so I'm looking over these lecture notes, and I said, you know, normally you cite in the lecture notes where you're getting this information. But I don't see it here, but I just have to say, I think this entire theory is just BS. Except I didn't say BS, I used the full word. And the whole class was quiet, you know, went silent. And he looked at me, And I said, this is baloney. Kids aren't apathetic. I don't think they're apathetic. I think you're overloading them with information and you're not getting the results that you want, but that doesn't mean that they're apathetic. So I don't know which author you're quoting, but... And he looked at me and you know what he said? He said, I'm not quoting any author. This is a book that I'm writing. This is my theory. Yeah, thank you. That's exactly what the class said, too. And I remember I felt like a deer caught in the headlights, and I backpedaled like crazy. And I said, I'm really sorry. I did not realize it. If I had known that it was your work, I wouldn't have used calmer language. And he said, you know what? Later, he said, you know what? You're right. I said, kids, when you overload them with information like this, they may look like deer caught in the headlights, but they are actively engaged. Every teenager that I know wants to do something about the world. They want to make a difference. They want to make the world a better place. They're deeply compassionate people. They just don't have the power yet and the independence to be able to go do everything that they want to do. They care very, very much, but they're deeply frightened. When you throw all these statistics at them and tell them the world's going to end before they even get a chance to grow up, people can get paralyzed with fear and not know what to do next. That can happen to me if someone tells me, I mean, that's how I feel when I see all these riots going on. We talked about this in December, remember this? We talked about this. When I hear about all these riots going on and the race problems in this country and how many people are being disenfranchised in the LGBT community, in the black community, in the immigrant community, and everybody looks at me like I'm supposed to do something about it, I get a little paralyzed. That doesn't mean I don't care. That means I'm too frightened to do anything about it because fear is paralyzing. And I told this to him, and he said, and then we had the whole, you know, question about whose book it was, which didn't go down very well. But after the class, he said, you know what? I said, I'm so sorry that I said that. That was really rude of me. And he said, no, thank you. Thank you for saying that. He said, I realize that you're right, and I'm going to change the premise of my book and rewrite it. And he's going to start talking to kids differently. And in the article that I read, it said, throwing all of these statistics at kids is not going to save our environment. If you want your kids to help save the environment, teach them to love nature. Because then they'll understand how valuable it is, and they will do anything they can to save it. Take them on nature walks. Take them camping. Take them to Yosemite. I remember growing up at a place where we used to go camping where it was beautiful. It was beautiful. There was a lake and there were trees and there were little lizards running around. That's why my children chase lizards, is because I have taken them to that place. And it's gorgeous. I've driven up the California coast and I've seen the rugged ocean on one side and the towering redwoods on the other and the beautiful fog in between them. And it's awe-inspiring. If someone quotes statistics about... how trees are being destroyed in the rainforest, I don't know what to do about that. But if someone tells me that they're trying to take down the redwoods, I will be there. You watch. I'll be up that tree so fast. You can't chop it down because I'm in the middle of it, is what I'll say. When we experience the glory of God in nature, it's really hard to let it be destroyed. Most of the people, when they talk about having their conversion experiences where they find God, it's usually at youth camp. It's in camp where they're out in the woods, running around in the trees, worshiping under the stars, singing camp tales, singing campfire songs around the fire. If you want to save the world, teach your children to love nature. Teach your grandchildren to love nature. Show them how beautiful it is. That is the same awe that people who wrote the book of Genesis had. There are so many wonderful things in this world, and they are all so very, very good. Without them, we cannot sustain ourselves, and so we must sustain them. We must be good stewards, we must be good caretakers, and we must live in harmony with the earth. What we are talking about now as we're discussing global warming is identical to what they were discussing in the book of Genesis. Do not make any mistake about that. If you want to save the earth, revel in the glory that is around you and teach your children and your grandchildren to love nature. Can I get an amen to that?